Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of Conversations at the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week's episode focuses on the effects of globalization, trade, and the role of global cities. In this hour, we'll hear from Parag Khanna. He's at the Center on Asia and Globalization at the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy at the National University of Singapore. He's in conversation with Sean Randolph of the Bay Area Council. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. And now to our moderator, Sean Randolph.
It's a really a great pleasure for us to partner with the World Affairs Council for this event. And I think it's one you're going to find is a really a fantastic treat. I find what Parag writes about to be just fascinating. And you'll get to share tonight a much condensed version of his new book. He's written two books on global issues in the past of this nature. This is the third in a series. And so I think you've released both other books, or you've spoken about both books here before at the World Affairs Council. So Parag is reprising a visit to us in the Bay Area and the Council, so we're excited to have him here. By way of background, you all have his bios in your packet, but he is a leading global strategist, as I mentioned, a best-selling author, a contributor to CNN Global, senior research fellow at the Center on Asia and Globalization at the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy at Singapore National University. And on the business side, he's managing partner of Hybrid Reality, which is a boutique geostrategic advisory firm. I'd love to hear more about that. And co-founder and CEO of Factotum, which is a leading content branding agency. So a real global perspective. He pieces together lots of things that are driving the world economy. And tonight we're going to hear about the new book, Connectography, about how different kinds of infrastructure now are connecting the world in ways that really subsume or supersede what we normally think of as political national boundaries. Just to get the ball rolling, Parag, would you like to set the stage? Give us some of the highlights of the new book.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you so much, Sean. I'm really grateful for this opportunity to do this with you and to all of the other sponsoring organizations that have gotten behind this since we first met and spoke about it. And of course, to Carla and Mary and the World Affairs Council, this is, in fact, the third time I'm speaking here. It's very fulfilling and satisfying to come here for the third time for the completion of this trilogy. A lot of people ask me what comes after this, sort of what's the next book, and I say I don't know what the Latin word for a fourology or quadrology is, so I'm not going to do it. This is, in fact, the end. We'll find another reason, hopefully, to come back here, but I always enjoy fantastic audience and discussion. So, you know, this, and by the way, I'm very pleased that no one really struggles with the neologism connectography. Everyone seems to have their own way of pronouncing it more or less correctly, although with the neologism, you can kind of pronounce it any way you want, since it's a new word. But I felt it was necessary to do that. Not least, of course, there was a lot of pressure from my publicist to and publisher to come up with a title that would be snazzy. We struggled with it for a very long time, but it sort of resonated. Now, the point is, of course, it needs no explanation in the sense that you know you're talking about the fusion of connectivity and geography. And that's what I have found in the last couple of weeks. There's just been this enormous sort of, aha, yes, of course, we know it's true. We didn't have a word for it kind of thing. And that's very gratifying. And to me, though, you know, my deepest academic origins are in political geography. It's what I'm truly passionate about. And I found, though, that especially with just traveling and researching for years and years, that the connectivity, the infrastructural connectivity in particular, matters, is beginning to matter more. So this book is in one simple sentence about the gradual eclipsing or subsuming of political geography by functional geography, right? Which is moving from how we legally subdivide the world, which will always be there, but what becomes more important is how we functionally connect the world. And that is what we do with infrastructure. And there are three kinds of infrastructure. All of the infrastructures that we build are, generally speaking, either transportation, energy, or communications, right? They're highways or railways or bridges and tunnels, or there are oil and gas pipelines and electricity grids, or their internet cables and data centers and so, satellites and so forth. These are all infrastructures, and we have this ability to do what's called topographical engineering, to literally modify the planet to suit our purposes. And that is what we've been doing, and the process has only just begun. So we move from a world that is organized primarily according to divided nations and states with those boundaries that we think of as sacred or rigid, towards instead what I'm calling a global urban network civilization. And all four of those words matter. You know, it's urban because most of the world's population has already moved into cities, and that is accelerating. So by 2030, 2035, two-thirds, three-quarters of the world's population is going to be living in cities. It's a network. They're all getting connected to each other. That's what all that infrastructure does. It's global. It's everywhere. It's not just the Western world. It's not just New York and London dominating the world. It's major cities in every on every continent that are connecting. And it is a civilization in the sense, you know, towards the end of the book, I get into this idea of, you know, what does it mean to be a global society? It's not even terminology that we would have used at a certain point in time. I kind of trace the origin of the word infrastructure, the origin of the word globalization, all of this new vocabulary. Connectography is just the latest in a long line of neologisms to try and capture what this evolving phenomenon is. And I find that the most accurate way to describe the world today is not a Westphalian world of nation states and boundaries, but a global urban network civilization. When you think about how we actually use the planet, what it is, how we actually interact with each other, what is it that we're actually doing on a day-to-day level across our economies and societies, and even in terms of geopolitical tensions, it is in fact playing out through the mechanisms of connectivity amongst the world's principal cities and the political authorities that govern them.
Fantastic. There's so much in the book we could talk about. Maybe we'll start with just a couple of questions, and then in a while we'll get to your questions and we'll have a really deep discussion. So one of them is you talk about supply chain connections across the world and the communications and other infrastructure that's tying us together around different kinds of aggregations of interests and capacity. It also looks, though, like there are some really powerful degenerative forces underway around the world that are building, and especially in the U.S., if you look at the current primary election season, seem to be pushing in the opposite direction from globalization. It's turning out to be a pretty bad word right now in the election. One of the worst things you could talk about is being pro-trade. And so there's these, you know, things like TPP, TTIP, the agreement with Europe, who knows what's going to happen. So I want to read this little thing. I love the way it's drafted, but get your reaction. This is a blog from Nathan Gardels at the Berggruen Institute. The title is Why the World is Falling Apart. And I'll just read a few lines and get your reaction. It says, the fearful and fearsome reaction against growing inequality, social dislocation, and loss of identity in the midst of vast wealth creation, unprecedented mobility, and ubiquitous connectivity is a mutiny, really, against globalization, so audacious and technological change so rapid that it can barely be absorbed by our incremental nature. In this accelerated era, future shock can feel like repeated blows in the living present to individuals, families, and communities alike. Philosophers and social thinkers have long noted the relationship between such anxiety or sense of threat and the reactive fortification of identity. The greater the threat of violence, upheaval, or exclusion, the more rigid and solitarist identities become. The lesson here is that political and cultural logic, let's say economic logic, rooted in identity and ways of life cultivated among one's own kind, operate on a profoundly different track than economic and technical logic. So if we're witnessing this surge of disintegrative forces, and who knows where it's going to go, how does that fit into the worldview you're describing of, in fact, increasing integration based on different kinds of units? Mm-hmm.
I love that quote from Nathan, who I was actually hanging out with last night. And that was written, what that passage you read was written a couple of years ago. But last week in that same newsletter, he quoted what I'm about to tell you, which is the answer. So I know that he's on my side in the long run. But it's interesting, though. Let's just go back. I hate to be the logical stickler here, but when he says that philosophers have long noted that there are tribalist reactions to certain phenomena, he must have been talking about certain phenomena prior to globalization if this is something that philosophers have long noted. So globalization can't be that which is to be blamed for a reaction that has happened many times prior to globalization, right? And I think this is very important, this sort of insight, if you will, into or as a response to what he said, because when you hear the scapegoating of our politicians of globalization, everyone is to blame except us and our government. Suddenly, globalization is this force that we have nothing to do with. Suddenly, China is to blame, and Mexico is to blame, and this trade agreement is to blame, and so on. But never is Washington or our government or our mismanagement of these global forces is ever to blame. And I find that rather odd, I have to say. Just to be perfectly clear, for those who don't know their history or buy into someone else's version of history, the United States is the foremost architect of the world trading system. It is the driver of global financial integration. It is the largest and deepest pool of capital markets in the world. It is the largest asset holder in the entire world. It has absolutely no equal of any kind in this regard other than the European Union in some respects. So to now suddenly blame all of that system that we have been building as a country, as an empire, as a superpower for the last 70 years because of X number of jobs lost in one particular sector of the economy in a particular set of Midwestern states is a bit of a stretch, okay? So that's one thing. And I think it's important to bear this in mind because 15 years ago, 12 years ago, when we began to worry about job loss due to outsourcing of labor to Asia and Latin America and so forth, there were other countries facing the same dilemma at the same time. Germany did as well, right? We had a presidential election 12 years ago in which there was a candidate who you may remember, his name was John Edwards. Didn't get very far in the race, but John Edwards' platform was, we need worker retraining, right? We need to we're losing jobs, we've got to upskill our Americans and resort them into new sectors of the economy. Well, raise your hand if you're aware of our federal worker retraining program today. Right, so we didn't do it, right? But Germany did, and Switzerland did, and South Korea did, right? We are to blame for not adjusting to the globalization, which has, on the whole, benefited us a great deal. So this is the next point. The measurement of whether or not globalization is good or bad should be slightly more utilitarian than what happened to X number of automobile manufacturing jobs in Michigan or other kinds of things. We don't take into account, or we should take into account, certain politicians, I should say, don't take into account the extent to which, because of globalization, everything we consume and buy is a lot cheaper. Right, therefore our productivity improves to some degree, the cost of living goes down in the aggregate. And by investing in other countries, by offshoring certain jobs, or just by investing in Asian markets, those economies grow and their people have a higher consumption capacity, right? If the people of Thailand and China did not become the epicenter of manufacturing supply chains, we wouldn't talk about this great, thriving, emerging middle class of 3 billion people in Asia to which we now want to sell our stuff, because they would never have become a middle class. So now that most of the Fortune 500 generates more revenue from exports abroad than from revenue at home, surely we've created some jobs, a benefit, and people in America benefit from trade relationships with those countries. In fact, you can measure this very well. There are tens of millions of jobs in America that depend not only on exports abroad and from foreign investment into America that generates more exports as well, because the European Union and other countries invest a lot of money here, and they actually bring technologies and jobs and so forth. So if you're a presidential candidate who says, I'm going to build a wall, and I'm going to cut off this, and this trade agreement is bad, you don't really understand the relationship between trade, investment, and supply chains. And granted, it's not easy, but it's also not rocket science, right? You can see how some automobile jobs are now being outsourced to Mexico, but Mexico has better trade agreements with Latin American countries, which means that if we manufacture in Mexico, our companies wind up selling more cars and generating more revenue. That then can be reinvested in higher-end jobs and automobile parts, the high-end kinds of things, the reflective lights and the airbag sensors and all these things. And so we actually, you know, so wages for some people go up, right? So I think that it's, if you use specific examples, you get a much better sense of how there is a distribution of benefits from trade as a whole, both on the small scale and the large scale. And it would be wise for whether, to be honest, because Hillary Clinton has herself flip-flopped on TPP, I kind of wish that someone could make the one-minute statement with some of the data that I just presented and just make clear that as a net, you know, sort of, again, utilitarian calculus, trade is good. But it does require that government get involved and that industry get involved in that process of helping people adjust. Like I said, we have known for more than a decade that our citizens need, our workers need help adjusting. We have failed to provide it. And that is directly or indirectly can be, you know, the rise of Trump and Sanders can actually be attributed to that.
Now, staying on this theme of integration, disintegration, in your book, sort of in the supply chain theme and the idea that sort of larger political units are in some cases coming apart based on essentially a sense of self-determination among smaller ethnically or groups defined by their interests. And so in the case of Europe, looking at what the Northern League, if they'd like to separate from Italy or Catalonia in Spain, or is it a Grexit or is it a Brexit out of the EU? So I can see the logic of this is better when smaller groups, smaller, more cohesive groups have more self-determination and they connect to the world. But so is it always a good thing necessarily that we have this kind of devolution to smaller units? So what comes to mind, for example, is in the European Union, where arguably, as you point out, the Spanish government hasn't handled the Catalonians very well. Right. They haven't given them the same deal, the Basque God of, you know, quasi-independence. But if the UK leaves, and let's say others were to leave, when I think of the EU, I think of them as a place that shares a lot of values with America. And we together project those values around the world. And then when we're dealing with, say, the Chinese, who don't share many of the same values, or with the Russians, who have a different set of interests, that having this relationship of a strong Europe with the US, it conveys certain things, it balances certain things in the world, and it could be weaker. Mm-hmm. Our influence could be weaker without a stronger, more cohesive Europe. Right. So I think that the question behind that is really, how far can or should this trend toward devolution to smaller political units go? And are there times when that's going to be counterproductive as opposed to productive?
Sure. I think we have to distinguish between the virtue of devolution as the result of democracy and the strategic consequences and utility of it. You know, something can be good, which is to say self-determination. If you believe in Woodrow Wilson, I think of myself as a fairly radical Wilsonian, right? I believe in the self-determination of peoples. You cannot possibly believe in democracy and not believe in devolution, which is one of the lengthy arguments I have in the book. The world has grown from 50 countries 70 years ago to 200 today. If you believe that European empires should remain intact and, you know, the countries in Africa and Asia should never have become independent, then fine. If you believe in democracy, you have to believe that people everywhere have a right to determine their form of government and the shape and size of their polity, ideally in nonviolent ways. So whether through violence or nonviolence, we have wound up with this world of 200 countries. We're creating new countries all the time. You know, Kurdistan, Palestine, you know, East Timor was just created, South Sudan, maybe Catalonia, maybe Scotland, and so on. This is not a force that can be stopped, and democratization promotes devolution. as does transparency. What's happening in Catalonia and Venice and other places, and even just at the city, at the urban level and the provincial level around the world, is that cities and provinces are saying, wait a minute, we pay in X amount in taxes to the capital and we get Y amount back, and X is about double Y. So this is not a good deal, especially, you know, rich provinces like Catalonia, which has Barcelona and all the tourism money comes in and so on. So they're saying, we just want more fiscal autonomy. But when they get, when the reaction is this almost suppression, right, in the name of, you know, maintaining a cohesive state that is potentially, you know, inefficient and disadvantaging those provinces, they get very angry. And then, you know, you sort of you try and beat it down, and it jumps up and sort of bites you in a way. So I think that the most important thing also is that when you have this devolution, it's a step in a larger process towards aggregation. And what we miss in this fear of tribalism is that tribalism is the midway point towards globalism. And we're just looking at the here and now. What if Catalonia becomes independent? What if Scotland becomes independent? Those provinces, the first thing on their platform is that they'll join the EU, right? But we're not worried about what they're going to do day after tomorrow. We're only worried about tomorrow. And yet you should, in fact, think ahead and realize that around the world, we have this regional consolidation growing. We have the European Union. We have movements towards a South American Union. We have an East African community. We have an economic community of West African states. We have the ASEAN grouping in Southeast Asia. So we don't just have devolution. We also have aggregation, these meaningful, increasingly optimal regional units that are very important. Brexit is slightly different because if, you know, Britain steps out of the EU, it hasn't said what we're going to do next is to re-aggregate into new clusters and groupings. Look, every country has a right to screw up. When you screw up, no one's going to stop you from screwing up and get in your way. They're going to take advantage of your mistakes. So I can't stand in the way of Britain making that mistake of wanting to devolve away from its largest investor without a strategy for how it's really going to be part of a larger and more powerful negotiating unit, such as the EU. And this is a part of your question. The European Union is the largest trade power in the world. It can take China to court in the WTO and win, which it does. The US can do that. Britain cannot do that. So when Boris Johnson, who I used to really be a big fan of, but then he really messed up by being pro-Brexit, when he goes around saying, we're now going to negotiate as equals and with great flexibility, he uses all these buzzwords, you don't have flexibility. The second you are no longer teamed up with Brussels, which represents the largest economic entity on the planet Earth, and you want to negotiate with China, what do you think? China is going to eat you for lunch. Right? They will have no leverage. London is already becoming a wholly owned subsidiary of China anyway. So again, it's their mistake to make, right? It would be better, and you're absolutely right in the premise of your question, it would be better for the West to remain more united in order and be sort of a super cultural and economic region with the TTIP agreement going through so that they can negotiate with greater leverage over China on standards and other kinds of things. If Britain pulls out, not only is it their mistake, it's going to hurt Western collective leverage. And that's why President Obama took out an op-ed in The Telegraph to urge them not to do so. And come mid-June, I hope they'll listen. This is why I'm against populist politics, because it's not rooted in any way in the kind of, you know, the sort of obvious logic.
Well, we're certainly having a run of populist politics right now.
No,
we'll see where that takes us. Maybe a couple last questions before we open it up on the theme of infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So China's Maritime Silk Road, the One Belt, One Road initiative, big piece of infrastructure linking Asia, China with Europe. People can say there are political agendas behind that, maybe multiple agendas, but you have to say it's a very audacious project. Any thoughts on that?
Quite a few, in fact. It's a pretty significant component of this book is how infrastructure has become a major tool of geopolitics. And it always has been, actually. If you think about European empires, they built the railways that helped them extend their influence into interior Africa and across South Asia. The 19th century Russian czars used railroads to extend into the heart of Central Asia. So infrastructure has always been a very important tool. The Roman Empire, Ottoman Empire, and other Affairs could only extend as far as their road networks would allow. So we've always had, but we've never had this scale of this mega infrastructural topographical engineering, which is so sturdy and quite frankly more powerful and meaningful than these, you know, sort of vague and weak and arbitrary political boundaries. And that's especially true in the former Soviet republics of Central Asia, across which China is paving its way from west to east as we speak. Now, I've spent a lot of time in these parts of the world, and this Asia Infrastructure and Investment Bank, that was really one of the big stories of 2015, I assure you it will be the big story of 2025 as well. And it'll probably be the big story of 2035 also, because it has been 25 years since the Soviet Union collapsed. And ever since that time, China has begun to build these pipelines and railways and highways and so forth to extract the resources from Russia and Central Asia all the way to the Caspian Sea, and to smooth the export in the opposite direction of finished goods, you know, of electronics and so forth. That's Chinese neo-mercantilism. It's not neo-colonialism. It's not occupying a single foreign country, right? It's not subduing them. This is, analogies to British colonialism are so off the mark, because this is a different century or a couple of centuries off. This is neo-mercantilism, a new way of doing what empires have also done for a very long time. So this Silk Road process, this One Belt, One Road, is going to continue. And, you know, it's funny, again, from a geographic standpoint, who grew up being told that the continents in the world, right? There's Europe and there's Asia and there's Africa and there's South America. Do you remember? Who learned that Europe and Asia are different continents? Oh, come on, admit it, right? Right? Okay. So I know that you can see that this is not the case. There is the largest continent in the world. It's called Eurasia. And yes, there are different cultural spheres in Eurasia, but it is one piece of land, one really big piece of land. And it's getting connected together from China going east to west and from Europe going west to east. It is knitting itself together into a real supercontinent that is increasingly economically integrated. Now, we talked about the transatlantic relationship earlier. Europe today is trading almost as much with China as it is with America. And that's before all of these infrastructure networks are even complete. Just imagine what happens when they are. So the European geopolitical calculus is changing very quickly from one that says, well, we have this great Western cultural community that binds Europe and America together across the Atlantic, to one that says, there's $150 billion on the table to build some railways and pipelines, and we have lots of construction and engineering companies in Italy and Switzerland and Germany and France. Let's get in on this action. And that's why European countries tackled over each other to get in on the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, even though the Obama administration tried to convince them not to. And so, yes, this is the most significant geopolitical event of the 21st century. Is not the Iraq War, it's not the Afghan War, it's not ISIS, it's none of those things. It's the infrastructural unification of Eurasia, and that's not just economically convenient transactions. It winds up being a very geopolitical phenomenon.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of conversations at the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales. We're hearing from Parag Khanna of the National University of Singapore. He's in conversation with Sean Randolph of the Bay Area Council. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. Ours is a membership organization. You can visit us or join us at worldaffairs.org. And now back to our conversation.
So let's talk, before we open it up to the audience, about a different kind of infrastructure, internet,
yep,
virtual. I think you could make the case pretty easily. Certainly that's the perception around the world, that the Bay Area is the global epicenter for technology development around the internet and all kinds of virtual connection. Certainly many of the leading companies that are changing that world are located here. So this may be a two-part question. So this is the first part. How about the Bay Area? So how do you see the Bay Area fitting in on your global map of connected cities and regions?
Right. I very, very strongly. So in this global urban network civilization, the connectivity among cities, digital infrastructure being the newest layer. I call it the digital supply chain, if you will. If it's all about supply chains of different kinds, the internet is this, the newest kind of supply chain. I say it's infrastructure and supply chains of goods were the World Wide Webs before the World Wide Web, right? So cities become the key nodes, right? The centers of data. So in the book, we've created these maps that really show the linkages among cities, the bandwidth speeds that link different cities, and so forth. So a place that is, of course, the main thesis being the most connected societies are going to win. That society can also be, really the urban level society. So this Silicon Valley more broadly is an example of obviously a hyper-connected urban region whose economic value is generated so much from cyber civilization, if you will, and being, if you will, the capital of cyber civilization, you could almost say. And a lot of that rests on its own ability to not only innovate certain technologies and products, but to directly govern and manage far-flung supply chains for the productions of those hardware and software, distributing the outsourcing and recombining technologies here, obviously generating the lion's share of the profit from it and aggregating it here. And the companies have become so powerful. I call them stateless superpowers in the book and some of my other writing. The companies that we have thought of as being so intrinsically American because of their origins here are also distributing themselves very, very globally to capitalize on the very networks that they have built. So the phenomenon of inversion and transfer pricing and the money that Apple and Google and other companies are holding offshore, so to speak, is just one example of this phenomenon. So Silicon Valley has become so powerful, not only economically and infrastructurally, but it's driving companies are now leveraging those networks to themselves go global and spread around the world. Because, of course, again, as I mentioned earlier, the majority of the Fortune 500 generates more revenues from abroad than from home. That applies to technology companies as well. So, in a way, I didn't write this in the book, but maybe I should go back and say, San Francisco is the capital of cyber civilization. It really is.
You can write that.
next edition.
Next edition. By the way, on that subject, do efforts, say, by the Chinese government to control the internet, or efforts underway in some countries in Europe, for example, to control the cross-border flow of data, for example, by requiring our companies and others to put servers in their country right. So they can manage it within their boundaries, is that a significant threat to this process, or is that just a managerial blip?
Right. No, and I don't want to underplay the extent to which, the internet is becoming something more of a splinternet, right? Which is another great neologism coined by my friend Scott Malcolmson, who's just written a book with the same title. That is obviously a significant phenomenon. In this book, I talk about the difference between the geopolitics of the internet, which is the physical dimension you're talking about, the location of submarine cables, of data centers, and so forth. So the geopolitics of the internet is certainly about all of these, the legalization and the grounding and the securitization of this infrastructure. And like the other strategic infrastructures in the book, like pipelines, internet cables start to take on some of those characteristics. So that's the geopolitics of the internet. Then geopolitics in the internet or within is, of course, cyber war, IP theft, and all of these kinds of things. Both are going on. Then, to your question about the Great Firewall and so forth, we have to put this in context. On the one hand, it's obviously troubling, right, that the places that are sort of self-restricting, this sort of free flow of information. On the other hand, the total volume of flows across these societies is still growing tremendously, right? And of course, many people have the ability to reach outside through VPNs and so forth. There's a lot of slippery data is a lot slipperier than oil, as I argue. Also, if China wants to have global technology companies and also global financial instruments like payment systems and a global satellite network, all of these things that it's trying to set up, and it wants to go global with those products, it also will have to open up into these sort of two-way streets. So there's going to be a point in time, I think, when there are limitations to how much the growth companies that China wants to encourage can actually grow, unless they are more open and able to be part of these two-way and multi-directional processes, with the companies and counterparts outside of China that have completely different norms and standards and protocols for information sharing and so forth. So I think that over time, what we're seeing with the Great Firewall is an attempted series of frictions, right? That's what they are. It's not a total blockage, they're frictions. Over time, those frictions eventually give way to flows. That's not to say, of course, that that means that Western companies are going to gain the upper hand. I mean, the Great Firewall is equal parts, perhaps, blocking out unwanted data, but it's also about, it's actually classic industrial policy, right? It's protecting your nation in industries as they grow, so generating all of the rivals to Western technology companies in hardware and software. They may not be as good, but if you are blocking out foreign competitors and letting the locals get dominant market share, it's obviously good enough, so to speak. It's not optimal. We have lots of suboptimal processes in the world. This is one of them. But again, this is their choice to make. Generally speaking, we have data that's fairly clear that when companies choose to restrict and impose tariffs on technology goods that are of higher quality and probably cheaper from America or elsewhere, and instead force their citizens to use suboptimal products and technologies, it's their own people who wind up getting hurt. We see this in Russia and Vietnam and other places. So again, that is their choice to make. It is not the choice that is in the best interest, probably, of the companies that and the entrepreneurs that they want to see grow. But they're doing it for political reasons.
Then the second part of the Bay Area question was, if we connect here to major urban centers around the world, and as you write in the book, that the global economy is more and more becoming based not on national economic units, but on economic cities and regions. And I'm sure that different cities and regions are critical for different reasons, depending on what their strengths are. But if you were to identify what you think are the top 10 or 12 most globally connected cities or regions in the world, what do you think they would be?
So there are there are about 50 major mega cities in the world around the year 2030, and most of them are already mega cities today. So some of the maps in the book show how the clustering of the world population into these urban centers pushes us into a world of about 45 to 50 megacity regions. Now, you don't have to be a megacity demographically to be economically important, right? But that said, most of them are. So about 50 of them. And because you already have to almost be a megacity to be one in 2030, the maps that I've made actually are going to be accurate 15, 20 years from now, and they're going to show what the principal cities are. You'll find, of course, most of the world's megacities are in Asia. That doesn't mean that the world will be dominated by Asia per se, because, of course, Asian cities are overpopulated and inefficient, right? It's not a virtue to be a gigantic city of 100 million people with lots of pollution. That's not a good thing. But they have 5 billion people in the greater Asian region, so they have to find a way of harnessing that potential, and urbanization is history's way of, sort of squeezing productivity and output out of people. So that's what's happening. I believe that the relationship among cities is generally more conducive to positive-sum logic than relations between countries, right? So I coined this term the Pax Urbanica, right? An age of peace among cities, because cities aren't actually necessarily interested in expanding their territorial control over foreign territories. They obviously exploit their own hinterlands for food and other resources, but they're interested in growing trade. And you cannot calculate the economic value of any of the megacities that are so crucial for national and regional economic growth without understanding the value of the flows between them. You can't say that Lagos, Nigeria is a great megacity. It has a GDP of $6 billion. And say, well, of that $6 billion, how much is because it is a trading hub, because it's open to flows, imports and exports and knowledge and talent and technology and so forth. So the more we move into a world of cities that benefit from connections with each other, the more sort of, prosperous it will be. So it's not a world of 20 or 30 or 40 such cities is not a world of competition among those 40. It's actually a much, much richer world. That's actually sort of Metcalfe's law in action, right? The value of the network grows in proportion to the number of nodes in the network, and that's what's happening with this sort of world of connected cities. So again, Silicon Valley clearly a significant hub in all of that. As you well know, because of what your council and institute do, when foreign leaders come here, delegations come in droves, Washington is not where they go to learn how to run their cities and their countries. Maybe they make a perfunctory flyby, you know, and they obviously want to get a photo op with Obama. But you will not learn anything about how to run your country better by coming to Washington, right? You're gonna come here, and that's why you're so busy for exactly this reason. And I think that is part of this diplomacy, right? The diplomacy among cities becoming, you know, telling us a lot more about how the world works on a day-to-day level than just looking at what happens at the United Nations or the World Bank. So congratulations to you for being a driver of this, ambassador of this diplomacy.
Well, we're fortunate to be in one of those key cities and regions where we do attract people from around the world, companies and governments, and it's a rich conversation. I think in U.S. politics, people often say that the most significant leaders are often mayors because they're dealing with real problems on the ground.
Yeah. You know, there are more heads of state today whose previous job was mayor than ever in history, right? And that's telling, because once you've been a mayor and you've ensured that the trash is delivered on time, the trains run on time, that you can manage a budget, you can herd the cats, you can deal with the unions, whatever, you're qualified to run a country. In fact, you know, I mean, I think it may be a letdown to run a country where things, a federal unit where change happens so slowly, versus a city where change can happen quickly. And there's very impressive mayors all over the world. I'll tell you, with someone with a geopolitical defense background, I've spent a long time traveling around meeting lots of defense ministers and so forth. And now when I go to cities, I want to meet the mayor. I want to meet the mayor's head of international affairs. I want to meet the guy who's trying to merge his city stock exchange with that in another city. The one who's trying to set up the airline connections between cities. That's how change happens. That's where growth comes from. You know, when Mayor Bloomberg was thinking of running for president, he had a lot of support for this reason because he was a successful mayor of New York. I met Mayor Garcetti of Los Angeles just the other day. He's a very impressive guy. This is a worldwide phenomenon. I can actually tell you, you name the country, I can probably tell you who the president will be within 5 or 10 years if I've met the mayor, and if I think, you know, if I project that he's doing a good job. You've never heard of half these people, of course. It's hard enough to remember the names of presidents of other countries, right? But if a mayor is impressive, you can pretty much be certain in a lot of countries, like 40, 50 countries, I'll tell you that he's going to be president within 5 or 10 years. Mm-hmm. It just happened in Argentina. It happens all the time.
Great. Well, let's get to some questions now. We have one from Jesse Hahn, who's the executive director of Meeting of the Minds, mm-hmm. and one of our sponsors tonight. Indeed. So thanks, Jesse.
Thanks, Jesse.
And the question is, how does your work build on Saskia Sassen's work and her research, and how would she respond to your frame of connectography?
Right. She loves it. So her name is on the back of this book. She's an icon, a mentor of mine, and I launched this book 2 weeks ago in her lecture hall at Columbia University. So I consider her one of the absolute most, you know, sort of profound influences on me. And she is was way ahead of her time in writing about what she called the circuits among professional classes across cities. And what I've done explicitly in the language in this book is to sort of update her talk around circuits. And many of you, let's just say for a moment that all of you work in the tech sector. Of course you don't, but let's just say. Technology workers around the world have so much in common because they almost rise and fall based on the performance of companies in that circuit. So much depends on VC capital from this region. If the dot-com bubble bursts, or if there's another bubble here, if it bursts, it's going to affect technology people all over the world. When oil prices collapse, the oil workers in Fort McMurray, Canada, and in the oil fields of Texas and of Russia and of Malaysia all suffer simultaneously, right? And so they have more in common almost with each other than they do with their next door neighbors. So commodities prices fell, and it's hurt a lot of American businesses, right? Has it hurt you? Not so much. Right? So within each geography, there's this disaggregation into what professional category and circuit you belong to. And that's Saskia Sassen's, one of her great insights. And I reference it constantly in this book.
You mentioned earlier, when we talked about the Bay Area, the large companies here, the tech companies that now extend their presence and certainly their services and technology around the world, the supply chains that feed that. So we have a question here. Are you concerned about the challenges multinational mega companies pose to the sovereignty of nations?
Right. So the notion embedded in the question is the notion that, you know, the world has always been, is, and should be a world that is governed by the strict logic of sovereignty is the most important principle that governs mankind. I disagree. First of all, that's not really true. We've only had a world of actual sovereign, legally equal nations for about 100 years, and I am being generous because it's more like 96 years because the Treaty of Versailles and the League of Nations and the various international covenants that date to around 1919, you could say, is when decolonization really began and states sort of became relatively equal. But don't forget, in the Cold War, it was not exactly an equal world. So we've never lived in that world in which sovereignty was really the paramount principle. Power has always been. And now I'm saying that connectivity is a form of power. So to me, you know, if you believe that let me just put it this way. These companies are simply a newer set of actors that's capitalizing on connectivity as a principle that's more powerful than sovereignty. Connectivity does more good for the world than sovereignty does for the world. I don't think one could possibly doubt the progress that has come in the world. In the early chapters of the book, I go back to the Industrial Revolution, and I take all the data. And by the way, lots of Nobel Prizes in economics have been given out for exactly this research that demonstrates how greater infrastructural and connectivity to investment and supply chains. Think of Robert Solow, Michael Spence, Angus Deaton last year. This is what a lot of their work has been about. Is demonstrating the extent to which global market integration is the path towards progress, knowledge transfer, technology transfer, and so forth. So we've had hundreds of years to prove that connectivity is really the agent of progress of human civilization. Sovereignty is an obstacle to that. Sovereignty is still important. Borders are still important. Having frictions and controls is important. You don't want diseases and pathogens and terrorists flowing through your borders. There's nothing wrong with having borders and frictions and controls. Every smart country calibrates those things so that the good things come in and the bad things don't, right? And that's what sovereignty should be for. But countries that diminish their own connectivity are often shooting themselves in the foot. And so, you know, companies are maximizing that. They are evading the current regulatory structure of the U.S. government legally, but at the same time, what they're teaching us and what they're teaching Washington is that just trying to grab taxation is not actually the path to progress. High taxation countries are not necessarily the ones that are going to be the most sort of, you know, innovative and attract the most investment. In fact, investment is going to yield higher returns in the long run. So lowering the corporate tax rate, which would bring some of those companies and their assets back on shore, is what you should want. Because if you're simply taxing revenue, then Washington's going to get it. You don't know what they're going to do with it. We do have a very large debt, so maybe that's some indication. However, if you attract investment from private corporations, that's going to create jobs, better infrastructure, training, ultimately more exports. So I think we haven't heard the last of this issue. This is just the beginning of the stateless superpowers. And the U.S. is going to learn to modify the tax code and attract more investment from its own companies. That's going to make America stronger, actually.
We have another question. I'm going to simplify it a little bit about digital divides. So we know that in the U.S. and around the world, there have been significant discrepancies in digital access. The questioner notes that women in Africa are less likely to have cell phones. So to what extent do those kinds of digital divides lead to larger divides, larger digital divides or disruption of connectivity?
You know, we've heard the argument for a long time that, you know, the digital divide is such a worrying trend. and that you know, unequal access is going to lead to you know, sort of the already, you know, distortion of the inequality that we already have. However, a bigger problem than the digital divide, a bigger problem than unequal access, is too little access. And this is something that I rail on, actually, in the conclusion of the book, because we have anti-globalization movements, anti-technology movements, anti-capitalism movements. The problem is not you know, the sort of globalization, technology, or capitalism. The problem is not enough of those things for enough people, right? If you want to solve the digital divide, you don't freeze in time, you know, the current structure of the society. You actually pump in more effort into spreading that technology. So if you look at, you know, if you look at some of the maps in the book that really show the number of people connected to the internet in different countries and the proportion of the population, what you find is, yes, you know, we're probably less than or about halfway there, right, when it comes to how much more connected individual people can be. Almost everyone has a mobile phone now, but not everyone has internet access, certainly not, you know, 3G, 4G, 5G speeds and so forth. The more we can do that, and we have better and better data about, again, the catalytic impact on GDP, number of percentage points gained in developing countries by empowering citizens with internet access. So I worry, I don't worry as much about the digital divide as I worry about you know, access and opportunity and spreading the technology more to overcome the divide. I don't think enough about being anti-trade is the right idea. I think we need more trade and more people participating in trade, right? And so on. So, you know, if you want to address these issues, the answer is not to sort of, you know, freeze time or roll it back.
There's another aspect of connectivity that you point out in your book, which is problematic, and that is the case of, say, sub-state actors like ISIS using this kind of technology. Yeah. So they've developed an extensive network using pretty sophisticated sort of technology and media. So do you see, the question is, security and defense becoming more distributed, more fragmented, more borderless in the face of access to all kinds of state, non-state actors, some of them not very nice, to the technology?
Right. So, you know, I mean, yes, groups like ISIS and so forth use social media as a tool of recruitment very effectively. But let's remember that they're sort of, you know, pushing on an open door, or there is this sort of, you know, this seething mass of disaffected male youth, you know, across the Arab world and across many developing countries, and quite frankly, apparently, also in Europe and America, because we have citizens from the West who have joined these organizations. They're not just thrill-seeking, right? So, you know, yes, these groups are exploiting these technologies and exploiting these vulnerabilities, emotional vulnerabilities. The solution is, of course, you know, the short-term solution is let's shut down their Twitter accounts and so forth. But that's not actually going to change the fact that you have all of these young Tunisians and Libyans and so forth who are still flocking to Syria, right? You have to do something about the social and economic conditions in those societies. So, you know, should we be waging the cyber war? Of course we should. Have bad actors always use the, you know, whatever technologies they can get their hands on? Sure. So is the fact that they're using cyber weapons a reason to, you know, shut down the internet? No, of course not. So, I think we have to take all of this, you know, sort of, you know, in the right proportions.
So this might be our last question. So it's implicit, I guess it's actually explicit in your book, the idea that cities and regions that are most connected have an advantage.
Yeah.
They have the greatest opportunity for growth and to leverage their resources. Would you play that in reverse to say cities and regions that are not well connected are at an inherent disadvantage in the global competitiveness game, right, and in the competition for resources and economic leadership in areas where they may have specialties but can't deliver them? So I think about a bigger region like the Middle East, where apart from, say, places like Dubai or Abu Dhabi that are super connected, it looks like a lot of the Middle East is sort of falling apart, and you've got connectivity through ISIS, but they're not connecting to these big global trends in the same way that much of the rest of the world, even Africa, is, because they're distracted by the politics. So how would you describe the dynamic of how cities and regions become more competitive by being connected, and who's being left out right now, and is that going to be a long-term competitive disadvantage for them?
So, first of all, can anyone name a successful country that doesn't have a stable, thriving, successful commercial center, a city? Can you have a successful country without a successful city? Can Afghanistan become a thriving beacon? Can it become the Switzerland of Central Asia unless Kabul is a functioning city? Can we resurrect Somalia from the war-torn, you know, from the civil war that it's endured for such a long time, unless Mogadishu is a stable, thriving Indian Ocean coastal port city? The answer is no, right? Cities are our most fundamental a societal building block, not countries, not empires, not nations, right? Cities. We've had cities for thousands of years. Empires come and go, nations rise and fall, especially in the Arab world. The city is always there. Alexandria, Tunis, Cairo, Baghdad, Beirut, thousands of years of history, right? The countries around them won't make it to 100, right? They won't make it to 100. The Arab world's countries that were created with the Sykes-Picot Agreement of exactly 100 years ago, right, to the day, most of them won't make it to 100, or those that were created in the 1940s, 50s won't make it to 50. Right? So the cities matter, and the cities become the foundation of the successful society around them. The more Arab cities will connect to each other in the trading networks that have flourished for millennia, the better off they will be. Now, again, you know, the Arab world is almost totally urbanized, right? Almost every one of the 400 million Arabs lives in cities. It's almost equal to Latin America because of the thing about the topology of Latin America. Almost all people in South America live on the coast, right? So there's actually a lot of potential for these for these societies, because they are already urban, which means there's a greater opportunity or ability or possibility to spread the key technologies that they need to sort of grow and thrive in the connectivity. So I hope that that's what can happen in the Arab world, is to stabilize cities. Think about it in counterinsurgency language. We've been following the Afghan war and the Iraq war for about 15 years now, right? And we've been talking about, you've heard this expression more than once, clear, hold, and build, right? Clear, hold, and build. It's the mantra of counterinsurgency. So we're not so good at clearing. We're not so good at holding. And so we never get around to the building, right? And my argument in this book is we should clear, hold, and build cities, right? Clear, hold, and build stable population centers in which you can have commerce and industry that people want to defend because their livelihood depends on what they're doing day to day in that city, whether they're selling tea or importing, you know, shampoo packets from Unilever or whatever the case may be. People who live in cities want their cities to be stable. No one wants to have to flee their city the way people have been fleeing Aleppo, right? So if we can start to think about the infrastructural element in our foreign interventions and occupations and in our strategies for the long term for these countries, our policies will be smarter and better and more attuned to their needs, and those countries will in the end be a lot better off.
Terrific. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the conversation tonight. We could go on and on and on. On behalf of the World Affairs Council and the Barry Council Economic Institute and Meeting of the Minds and Pacific Pension and Investment Institute, I ask you all to join me in thanking our terrific speaker, Parikonda, for this excellent discussion.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Sean.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of conversations at the World Affairs Council. Ours is a membership organization. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Parag Khanna of the National University of Singapore. He was in conversation with Sean Randolph of the Bay Area Council. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Additional funding for post-production is provided by Maria Starr. She's a member of the KQED Producer Circle. Our recording engineer is Jane Heaven. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.